The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. There are three periods into which the karmic consequences of good and evil fall. One is the consequence experienced in the present world. The second is the consequence experienced in the next world. And the third is the consequence experienced in the world after the next one. One must understand this very clearly before undertaking any training in the way of the Buddhas and ancestors. Otherwise, mistakes will be made and people will fail to understand clearly. In addition to this, their lives will become evil and their suffering will be prolonged. Why does Dogen, as he often does, and especially in this case, makes a very ordinary, prosaic statement about past, present, and future, and then say that this is very, very important to understand? When I first heard this, which was 40 years ago this year, that was what immediately I thought. Well, what a very ordinary thing to say. You know, there's the past, there's the present, and the future, and consequence. But what Dogen is getting at is something that I'm going to try to put in terms of past, present, and future. And before, what I'll call, for lack of a better term, before and after, as a way of simplifying it to the maximum amount. People, when they read about Buddhism or study Buddhist scriptures, come across the teaching regarding karma and rebirth and things along those lines, which strike many people, particularly in the 21st century or whatever century we're in, as hard to understand, sometimes coming across as arcane and confusing. What exactly is meant by this? And people get into discussions of, if there is no self, then how is it possible to have past memories? But I'm not going to be talking about that aspect of it. I'm going to be trying to get down to why Dogen says it's very important to understand this. Now, the crudest metaphor I can come across is, have most people here travel by train at some point or another? Some people who have come here have certainly gotten off the train in Dunsmuir, okay, in the middle of the night. It is kind of like, and this is a very crude metaphor, you get off the train at Dunsmuir with your luggage, okay? And the problem is you can't remember where you got on the train or what happened on the train. Maybe you were drunk. I don't know whether they allow this on trains, but that doesn't seem to stop some people. So when you get off the train, you have the luggage that you can't remember packing, and you are suddenly in this place, Dunsmuir, where you have to, shall we say, make a go of it, and all you have is some sort of past experience that you can't remember acquiring. Okay? Are you sort of following me? At least so far, because I'm about to make a little leap. Okay. Our lives are very much, from the Buddhist teaching perspective, like that. Okay, we arrive. The people around us at the time we arrive say we've been born. And depending on who we're surrounded by, they will think that somehow they created us. Okay, that usually is our parents. Or the doctors and nurses, for that matter. They will think that they created us and that we are some sort of new thing which it is necessary to mold, to fit the requirements of the people around us. Some of this is actually the basis of most Western educational systems. Leaving that aside, some of you have been to Throssell, the monastery in England. It contains one of my most useful metaphors. Throssell is in Northumberland, and there are large hills all around it, and very wide open. And at the bottom of the walk from the monastery, there's a road. It goes in both directions, and being a British country road, it's very winding. When you go down on that road, it's a very, very nice place to walk, as long as you remember, if you're not English, to stay on the right side, which is the wrong side over here, lest you get knocked down. But it's very lovely to walk along, and many times when I've been there, this way of explaining things has struck me. You're standing on the road. There's a magnificent vista over the river valley of the Allen River, West Allen River. And the road being winding, people or cars or what have you appear in the distance, and then we see them. And then on the other side, they pass us by, shall we say, or people, and they pass out of sight. All this is our experience, okay? Both not only in terms of roads, but in terms of life and death, in terms of the past, okay, and in terms of the quote-unquote future. All, on one level, Dogen is saying is that there is something before people appear on that road, and there is something afterwards. Okay? Out of this relatively simple understanding, relatively simple metaphor, comes a way of looking at karma. We may not know what happened before we arrived in Dunsmuir, okay, or remember it. And particularly as we get older, as some of us know, we forget, even within this lifetime. And yet we bear the consequences of, or the results of whatever happened on the train. That's simply the way it is, whether we know them or not. Just as if we set something in motion, and one of the easiest way of understanding it is those people here who have children, and those people from the 60s would be familiar with Khalil Gibran's thing on children. Your son, what is it? Your children are not yours. They're the sons and daughters of life's longing for itself. They come through you, but not from you. And, you know, they use the metaphor of shooting, that parents are like bows that shoot their children into the future, which they themselves cannot enter. Even though one doesn't know what will become of one's children after one passes away, okay, that is not, how do I put it? That, just like not knowing what happened before, not knowing what will happen in the future, is not an excuse for anything. So, as the Buddha said, if we want to know what happened around that bend of the road, or want to know what will happen around that bend of the road, we concentrate on what is going on now. Dogen puts it that to understand the way training works gives us the greatest possibility of freedom within the limits of birth and death. And he's constantly talking about how wide this is. The way I've just described it can seem quite limiting in terms of what we can know. The field of the present and our present lives is what we have to do something with. We cannot sit and mourn over the past or, as it says, long for some particular type of future without paying attention to what we are doing. The Buddha even said, whether or not one believes that there was an existence before this one or after this one, if you apply yourself to this particular life, at least you'll have some peace and quiet with the people around you in this present life. Okay. Now, sometimes this business of what I've just described as before and after is presented in such a way or understood in such a way as a type of doctrine that people have to force their minds to somehow believe. When it's not actually like that, because on one level it doesn't matter whether you recognize that the car that suddenly comes around the corner on that road, whether or not you recognize there was existence before, has no impact on whether or not it hits you. Whether or not it hits you depends upon, on one level, what you do, where you're standing at that moment. Now, on a personal note, when I first heard this, and the general teaching of karma and rebirth, etc., I didn't have any particular difficulty with it because of my own experience, you know, as a child. And I'm sure there are some children here who have tried to embalm dead frogs or spent a lot of time collecting plants that they didn't know what they were for and putting them into little balls, maybe not. There was a monk here once who used to got into trouble for shooting flaming arrows into neighbors' haystacks. I think there was just one incident. Or used to borrow his, I guess it's more than borrowing, he used to get his mother's cinnamon sticks and set them alight and offer them to the sun. This was as a teenager. He made the mistake of mentioning this to his parents. When he came in from, you know, being outside and had been looking rather gloomy and looked better, and his mother said, "Oh, what were you doing? What's, you know?" And he said, "I've been praying to the gods." He never repeated that again. It is a mistake to assume that these sorts of occurrences are the result of people, you know, watching too much television. Children have always had these things before there was television. A congregation member whose son used to, and she was very, very careful what she let the child be exposed to. And she was asking me, you know, these strange games the child seemed to play on their own. So I slightly wickedly said, "Ask him," in the middle of what he's doing. And so the little boy was strutting about, looking like he was giving orders and pointing rather contemptuously at things, including his mother. And so she said, "Like, what game? Who are you?" And he laughed at her, she told me, contemptuously, and said, "I am Raja." And she said, "Oh, okay, you know, what, are you married?" And he laughed at her and said, "I have many wives." And this is a very tiny little child. Children actually experience these things all the time. They are simply fragments. Okay. They do not necessarily have any particular consequence, any particular, import, except as indication of the before and after. Okay. Buddhism accepts and is comfortable with, as I say, that idea of that before we arrived here, that, well, this is even better, that doorway, that the world does in fact exist out there. And if you go up through that door, you're not going to encounter blank space. Okay? The part of the difficulty is we act all the time as if that were so. Okay? We act all the time as if somehow we should be free of whatever habits and inclinations we have. You know, so many people, I'm sure, in this have wished to be somebody else. Have they not, in their lifetime? Or wished to have another set of problems? The old Hasidic Jewish saying that if everybody hung their problems on coat hooks and everybody could take the ones they wanted, everybody would take their own back when they had a glimpse of other people's. Particularly, we seem to understand our own a little bit better. We often act and want that there should have been no before. If you understand what I mean by that, it's one of the actual causes of what the Buddha meant by ignorance and causes of suffering and causes of dukkha. Okay? We want to be without, well, I guess the Buddha would say we want a permanent separate self, but that gets sometimes into philosophy, which I don't want to get into. We want things to be other than they are. We want to have another set of luggage. You know, we got off at Dunsmuir. We want... you know, we want something other than what we have. This knowledge and recognition of there being a before and after is not so much impeding as freeing. Okay, my own experience, personal experience as a child, was when I... you know, I learned about Buddhism, but when I came here, the very liberating thing for me, which may not be for all people, was that there was a cause. There were causes for my present situation. It didn't suddenly come from God dropping it on me because he didn't like me. Or from some sort of hereditary thing that I could do, you know, nothing about. There were causes. It was explainable. If I could actually see. You know the old, very old saying, very useful nowadays. To know all is to understand all. To understand all is to forgive all. Okay? And a lot of Buddhist training is getting a head start. Whether or not one knows what the past was, whether one knows what the future, whether one does or is ever likely to know everything. We begin to practice reality, in the ways I've put it. It is why when the precepts are given in Buddhism, they make that curious phrase. Buddhism is full of curious phrases. To make them the eyes of all sentient beings. This is because whether or not we can see, practice of precepts helps us to be able to see a little bit further down that path than we could see otherwise, and a little bit further down where we came from. Because we can look and, you know, do not kill. And Dogen, in his explanation of this, likes to, well, it's older than he, but the explanation which takes it to the deepest possible level. No life can be cut off. What does this mean, no life can be cut off? It means that people kill or cut off in order to seek their own happiness. You know, just as people who have, recently blown themselves up. Every being, no matter how small and insignificant or how large, wishes for happiness. Most people wish for just the tiniest, littlest amount of happiness. Just the little, you see it on, this is going to sound really weird, but I'm going to go apologizing. America's Got Talent. Okay? See, people who are happy, just that people respond to them. That's why the practice of the Buddha Dharma is, it can be, you know, that old story of the Lemon Pang's family. And they used to live together, he and his wife and his daughter. I believe they had a son as well. And so, they're having one of their little Dharma discussions. And Layman Pang says, hard, hard, hard is the practice. Or maybe his wife says it's hard, but I can't remember. One of them says, hard, hard, hard is the practice. It is like picking up peppercorns out of the dirt. And the other one says, easy, easy, easy is the Buddha practice. It is like simply picking the tops off plants, you know, when you're gathering herbs. And then the daughter, who is who has the deepest understanding, says neither easy nor hard. And so I was going to come into the easy. I already come into the hard. Easy, easy, easy is the practice. Somebody asked me recently about a very deep question. How does one set the wheel of the Dharma in motion, and how does one keep it in motion? Okay? Quite an esoteric question from a certain perspective. And so I thought, This person does not want an ordinary answer. So I said, to set the wheel of the Dharma in motion and to keep it in motion, you do that which you do not wish to do. You go where you do not wish to go, and you help people you do not wish to help. That the setting of the wheel of the Dharma in motion is when we go past our own selfishness and pettiness, and instead, I mentioned to this person how I'm sort of a cheerleader sometimes when I come down here, to tell you the truth, for the novices, you know, keep on going, all the rest of it. And so I said that, because the way Dharma is learned in a monastery is studying people who have been training longer than you have. And so I said, if you look at the older seniors here, you will find that when a volunteer is being asked for to do a particular task, okay, that hasn't filled in on the schedule, there are, it is often these very senior people who actually have more to do who will volunteer to do it. And I said, it's a mistake to think that these people do not experience resistance in themselves. Okay? It's not that they cheerfully glide, you know, along volunteering for things. It is that they have learned to examine their own resistance and to step beyond it. Now, a number of people here, particularly if you are in certain professions, like doctors and nurses, learn this within the context of the profession. Okay, that within a particular context, you do what needs to be done. And parents are sometimes, parents sometimes learn this as well. You know, the child cries in the middle of the night and you have to get up. Willingness in this context is not the non-experiencing of resistance or reluctance. It is learning to where one wishes to, when the call comes, and one wishes to, you know, keep one's feet on the ground and not move, that you develop the habit of lifting your foot just enough and putting it a little bit ahead. And then you find that the other foot lifts up, and of course you go. People often think that Buddhist training, that people who have been in training for longer periods of time, experience lovely smoothness. As a matter of fact, that's why lay people sometimes admire monks and then go through periods of disillusionment, particularly if they live with them. And see that, you know, I remember somebody visiting us up on the mountain, a layman, you know, 1820 or something like that, some years ago. And he was just staying for a week or so. And it was just at the point where Relian and I had been getting on one another's nerves during the day. And we're glaring at one another from across the room when the fellow says, "Gosh, do you guys ever swear?" he said, "You're so peaceful and, you know, get along with one another so well." And as partly people get that impression, partly because one is concentrating on one's own stuff. It's not that one experiences it as a type of smoothness, except that one develops the habit of not paying so much attention to one's selfishness and pettiness when it arises. In the beginning, when you study the self, as Dogen says, you start noticing this pettiness and selfishness. Or what's frequent is when people come and begin meditating for the first time, they will approach me and say, my mind keeps racing. And I think, do I tell them or do I not tell them that this is actually the regular state of their minds? It's just they've never sat still. That this is what their minds are actually doing. Or, you know, I'm sitting, they say, I've meditated for the first time and I am all confused and my mind feels all clouded and heavy. And I think, do I say to them that this is probably the state they go around in for most of the day? Meditation allows us to see ourselves and circumstances as we are. That can sound wonderful in self-help books, doesn't it? To see ourselves as we really are, because we think, oh, that must be nice. But it isn't a very comfortable thing in the beginning. You know, we have to stop throughout the day. The nice thing about monastic life is that it continually pushes it in your face. Okay? And I've never been married, but I've gathered marriage can be very much like that too. And you start looking and you start realizing that you have a lot to do, in training, that actually we can be quite petty and, you know, selfish and annoyed in tiny little ways of no particular consequence. And the thing with the Dharma is, which is why Dogen says, to study the self is to forget the self. And why there's a lovely metaphor that when one is using a sieve to clean water, to sieve dirty things out of water, it's important in Buddhist training not to only keep looking in the sieve and examining all the dirty bits, but also to be aware of the water being cleaned. We talk about the koan of daily life, and I'm going to venture my own definition of a koan, whether the koan of daily life or the koan that you encounter in books. What they're all about is a problem that must be worked upon through the use of the opposites, but cannot be solved by that means. Training is like that, spiritual training. It cannot be arrived at through the opposites, but it must be worked on by those means. Once one comes to some understanding of this before and after, then it greatly helps with the quote-unquote situation in the world. You know, those set of words, whatever they mean. Because what we see in front of us on the news or whatever, and I sometimes shock people by saying it's very good to bear in mind, particularly for people in the situation of most of us, that when we see something on the television, however shocking it is to us, we are in fact not experiencing it. Remember, a Theravadin monk once said that to a group of people in an audience, and they were very shocked by it. Theravadins are more easy to get around being blunt. Mahayana people are supposed to do, you know, talk about bodhisattvas and compassion. It is not the same thing. And if we look at a YouTube video of somebody being killed, and we are describe ourselves as profoundly upset. It bears no relationship to being there. And we should not, we should remember that. Okay? It is not the same thing. Nyogen Zenzaki tells a very interesting story of a Soto Zen priest who came to North America, you know, a Japanese Soto Zen priest in the very early days, maybe the 1910s or 1920s, and, you know, was visiting his Japanese parishioners who had done quite well in the United States. And one of them had his company had an abattoir. You know what people know what I mean by an abattoir? A slaughterhouse. Oh, yeah, okay, well, I'm probably using pink bits language, you know, British. A slaughterhouse. And when the priest was taken on a tour of it, he fainted. And Nyogen Zenzaki makes a rather unsympathetic comment. He said, first of all, monks should not go to such places. And second of all, if they do, they need to see clearly. And he said, no doubt this monk thought they were very compassionate to be affected by it so that they fainted. But he said, actually, the monk should have seen clearly in those circumstances. The responsibility, this is from my perspective, the responsibility of people who train in any spiritual path, okay, I suppose especially for Buddhists giving before and after, is, and I harp on this point up on the mountain with my lay congregation and disciples, is that you can't afford to think in ordinary ways, to pick up one's viewpoints from the air, if you understand what I mean. You cannot afford to look at things in the way that most people do and to respond to them in the way of most people do. It is the responsibility of people treading a spiritual path to show an affirming flame, as W.H. Auden said, to both do so and to be seen to do so. It's why I myself, after initially being sort of dragged into, interfaith-type meetings, kind of against my will, a congregation member was very much into it, and I ended up into it. But continued to do so because I think that people of faith need to be seen standing with one another. Faith gets a very bad rap, as the expression is, particularly now, from different sides of the coin and the equation. We can be accused of being both naive in terms of the way the world works, or accused of being incipient fanatics. You know, that all it would take is something and we would go rushing off madly in all directions, except a good proportion of the people here were too old. You know what I mean? And that kind of helps. It's kind of like monastic life and great passions, you know. When you're young, you see somebody across a crowded room, if you know what I mean. When you're old, you think of, can I stand up and make it to the toilet? Or I experienced this great passion, but I've got to go to the bathroom quick. It's a great help. It's one of the great blessings. Or I've got to go, I've got to go take my nap. let's go out and conquer the world. No, I'm going to have my nap, or I'm experiencing indigestion. Very, very handy. very, very just wonderful. It comes with other difficulties, but so does life in general. You know, people will say about their pains of the earth, you know, their arthritis, etc. And I've never given birth, but I've heard that that cannot be a comfortable experience either. So in Lytton, where we are, you know, where I live in British Columbia, which is only a village of about 200 people, there are several different, there's Baha'is and Catholics, Protestants, some Muslims, and we get together once a month. And the way I've the way I think about it, the way I've experienced it, is when we do that, and yes, we're preaching to the converted, if you know what I mean. People who hate other religions don't generally turn up at these interfaith things. You know, they're too busy doing other things. Well, you know what I mean. And so you get a reputation, as somebody once said, simply sitting there and playing kumbaya, for those of you of that era, if you know what I mean. And so I once described it, and this is the way I experienced it. Oh, I've recommended sometimes a book called The Rain Ascends, okay, which I very much still recommend. It's a bit shocking, but it's a good book. And that we sit, for the most part, in a sea of merit, if I can put it that way. Okay. It exists. We actually, when we're sitting, we actually have our toes in it. Okay. It is there. It is possible to experience it. But on one level, it doesn't do us all that much good unless we put the effort into it. So whether prayer, meditation, sometimes people don't quite understand the purpose of ceremonial, but that's because they think ceremonial is a type of play acting. If you understand what I mean, a type of symbolism for something else, but in fact it isn't at all. Ceremonial, like the ceremony this morning, is of equal significance in terms of training as going to the toilet. Okay, it's all one. It's just that some means are of greater help in drawing that water up. Teresa of Avila, of the Catholic tradition, describes it in great detail, what she calls the 4 degrees of prayer. There's the water existing everywhere, and then there is the necessity to draw it up. Okay, she talks about buckets and then windlasses and water wheels, and then she said eventually it starts to rain. When you put in enough effort to draw the water up, effort must be made. Those of you more familiar with our particular period of type of meditation can look upon it as like the backward flowing method, if you understand what I mean. And sitting in meditation, drawing breath up and down the front, is often compared in China to a water wheel. Okay, and you set it in motion, and then it sets in motion itself and turns. And then one becomes aware of the broader turning of everything in that way. And in any case, the way I explained transfer of merit to the people at the interfaith thing was we are sitting with our feet in the water of compassion, shall we say. And we cause it to rise by meditation, by prayer. We cause it to arise. When it rises to a particular point, it turns into rain. What is that word? What's the word for moisture in the air? Condensing. It condenses into rain and then falls. Training is very, very much like that. Okay, we sit, we meditate, or precepts, or anything along those lines, or ceremonial, or anything. How do we experience the benefit of it? by putting definitive effort into it. Definable, actual effort that one can experience. Effort to sit still. Effort to do that which we know we should do, but we are very reluctant to do. All those efforts. And it is more than just effort. It is more than just a means of making ourselves nicer. Okay, or at least more manageable. It is more than a method of changing the self. It is more than, far, far more than becoming nice or becoming normal or becoming sane. We put the effort in and continually put the effort in and raise the effort. When the effort sufficiently permeates our lives, then it condenses into the rain of mercy, the rain of compassion that falls, as all the various scriptures say, on the just and on the unjust, on the little plants and on the big plants, on the deserving and the undeserving. Remember years ago, there was a discussion among some people who were staying here as when we do the Sagaki ceremony as to whether the hungry ghost deserved the merit that they had. And they weren't sure they wanted to offer any because the hungry ghosts were probably undeserving, sort of welfare bum hungry ghosts, if you understand what I mean. The rain falls on the deserving, on the undeserving, or else it would never fall upon us, after all. Falling on the deserving, on the undeserving, falling in places of clarity or places of confusion, falling exactly in those areas where we find it most difficult, falling in places of great violence and confusion. And as one of our scriptures says, nobody can do anything about this. Nobody can get in its way. Nobody can stop it falling. What we can do is contribute to it. And as human beings, that sometimes means that we are, of course, taking risks. But human life is not safe. Okay? Although God knows we act as if it were. We go about acting as if we're never going to die. I'm sure what will we do? But human life is not safe. So, what is it that is important to do? It is important to follow, create, and nourish the lines of compassion between people. To cross boundaries that one is reluctant to cross. I remember the first time I got invited to a mosque. And I went with all sorts of preconceptions, even though I, have a know about world religions. And I remember at an interfaith gathering, some people, well, California, some people are into hugging, at such places. I came from a non-hugging culture. I've had to adjust to it. So I'm standing opposite this Muslim lady. She's a professor of Arabic at UBC. And the moderator is urging everybody to hug the people opposite them. And she's looking at me and I'm looking at her, Muslim woman, Buddhist monk. And I said, I will if you will. um, that didn't take all that much courage. But oftentimes to not be and not be made to fear our neighbors. And that's one of the aspects of it that I've talked about, not falling into ordinary type of thinking. It's very easy to be panicked, okay, by people screaming about fire in the theater when the most important thing is not to run but to make a definitive, you know, exit, if I can put it that way. Because of their limitless compassion, the Buddhas and ancestors have flung wide the gates of compassion to everybody. You need no further teaching than the above in order to show true gratitude, and you must show it truly in the only real way in your actual daily life. Our daily life should be spent in selfless activity with no waste of time. Homage to all the Buddhas in all worlds. Homage to all the Bodhisattvas in all worlds. Homage to the scripture of great wisdom.